Welcome to another exciting episode of NIDS Knowledge, a weekly show of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies, where we advance peace, promote stability, and help you to think deterrence. This episode is part of our regular Deterrence Down Under series, focused on Australia and our deterrence challenges in the Indo-Pacific region. Good day from Canberra. We hope you enjoy the show. Hi, I'm Dr. Carl Rhodes.
Hey, I'm Christine Leah.
And we want to wish you a happy holidays and welcome you to another exciting episode of Deterrence Down Under. Today, we are lucky to have a pair of RAND researchers as our guests, Dr. Dahlia Goldfeld and Nathan Beauchamp-Mustafaga, who we're going to discuss with them their latest work titled Denial Without Disaster. So avoiding disaster is always a good thing. But they specifically examine methods to keep a conflict between the U.S. and China over Taiwan under the nuclear threshold. So Dahlia is joining us. She's a senior information scientist at RAND, specializing in the Air Force adoption of emerging technology and modeling and simulation. Disclaimer, Dahlia and I did work together at RAND a bit, and she's a smart person. Nathan, also very smart person, did some work for RAND Australia while I was director there. He's a senior policy researcher at RAND, and he focuses on Asia security issues. And just a reminder, as we get started, the views of the hosts and our guests are their own and don't represent any institution with which they might be affiliated. So we'll start with a couple bits of deterrence-related news from Australia. Firstly, the Royal Australian Navy successfully fired a Tomahawk during test and evaluation off the west coast of the United States. So I don't know if you're watching, Dahlia, because I know you're in Santa Monica, California, but this makes Australia the only nation besides the United States and the UK to acquire and fire the Tomahawk system. So that's good news for Australia, moving along with that impactful projection. Secondly, former Defense Secretary Dennis Richardson was asked to review the Australian Submarine Agency after reports of widespread dissatisfaction inside and outside the organization. So the sub-agency oversees the $368 billion AUKUS nuclear sub-program and has a staff of 700. So clearly the recommendations are going to be critically important to the future of the Defense Force there. So let's hope they fix up some things there. And lastly, this is just a note of personal news because, you know, not necessarily personal news, but something I've worked on closely in the past on counter UAS. So the Australian Defence Force is moving forward with purchasing counter drone systems under Project Land 156. So they released an approach to market at the end of November. They invited companies to register to be a system integration partner to acquire counter small UAS systems, uncrewed aerial systems. Things are being seen off the east coast of the United States right now, from what I understand. The goal of the program is to deliver a minimum viable capability by the end of 2032. Seems a little bit long, but let's hope they can speed that along. It's an important program there. So, but let's jump right in. Denial without disaster. U.S., China, potential conflict over Taiwan. So maybe Dahlia or Nathan, can you describe the conflict you considered in the work and the basis of your analysis, just to get us started here?
Sure. We wanted to focus on Taiwan because DOD, U.S. DOD has publicly said it's the pacing scenario, and DOD has also said that China is the pacing challenge. But we wanted to have a very open-ended kind of both historically, kind of big picture strategic analysis, also Chinese language open source research informed, very broad hypothetical, theoretical approach to this study. And so we actually took a pretty broad brushstrokes view of what the Taiwan scenario in our research could be. So we just had a couple key kind of requirements that China decided to use force to unify Taiwan, that China executed an amphibious invasion along with some amount of air assault to actually move military forces across the strait onto Taiwan to seize the island, control it with military force. And also obviously required that the U.S. decided to intervene and use a kinetic force against the Chinese military to stop that invasion in order to defend Taiwan. Those are the key parts of it that we included. Obviously, you can imagine many, many different types of, specific details of a Taiwan scenario. I would commend to listeners that they're interested in walking through probably the best open source treatment of a Taiwan scenario. Our former RAND colleague, Eric Higginbotham, and a couple other fellow researchers at CSIS have produced a report that came out last year on some wargaming they've done over the last several years on Taiwan scenarios that's publicly available. That's a great report. And so if people want to really think through the nitty-gritty details of a Taiwan quote-unquote scenario, that's a great place to start. But for our project, our research, we took a very broad brush strokes for that because we wanted to have plenty of room to explore all the different ways that China might use nuclear weapons first in a conflict over Taiwan.
Interesting, interesting. Yeah, and China's ongoing nuclear buildup is clearly a concern here. Australia has been viewing it closely, and it's really changing the nature of deterrence in the Indo-Pacific region. So, I mean, how do you see China's nuclear forces have changed over the past, say, decade or so? And we can talk about force posture next, you know, but numbers and systems first maybe might be the good way to start.
Yeah, what we've seen is a pretty dramatic buildup from China with its nuclear forces, right? So even through the late 2010s, U.S. government and other private non-governmental analysts independently assessed that China probably had somewhere in like the low 2000s, or excuse me, low 200s, for nuclear warheads. But what we've already seen is that DOD has publicly said that as of May 2023, China now has 500 operational warheads. And the projection looking forward is by 2030, China may have upwards of 1,000 operational warheads. And DOD has also said by 2035, China might have 1,500 operational nuclear warheads. And so in the course of roughly 15 years, that means China will have gone from somewhere in the low 200s to maybe 1,500 nuclear weapons. Now, obviously, there's a lot of things that have to go right for China to actually build those out, operation and deploy those. They have to build those platforms successfully. That's not guaranteed, but that is the public DOD projection. That's a really dramatic change. And also, as you mentioned, Carl, this is not simply counting warheads. It's also been an expansion with the nuclear force structure. And so they have really kind of finally under Xi Jinping come to realize a decades-long modernization program for their nuclear forces. So they are building additional silos in the desert. It's probably the most well-known, most discussed part of their nuclear expansion. But we don't actually find that really the most dramatic part of it. For our research, our project, which is focused on Chinese nuclear first use, we really focused on their deployments of what DOD describes as a near continuous SSBN patrol. So that's submarine launch ballistic missiles on a nuclear submarine. That means that they're deploying them all the time or almost all the time. It makes them basically, on a basic assumption, survivable against adversary strikes. And so from that, what it really means is that now China has a secure second strike capability. So they detonated a nuclear weapon in 1964 for the first time. That means, basically 60 years later, they finally have a survivable second strike nuclear capability. And so for our project, that's one of the kind of coming in major analytic linchpins for our work, is that if China has a secure second strike, and we say with the recent DOD assessment that they're doing near continuous SSBM patrols, they have that, then the United States and coalition members for a potential future Taiwan scenario need to rethink their approach to escalation management in a U.S.-China conflict. So that's really the driving kind of underlying analytic linchpin for our research.
Oh, guys, thanks for coming on the show. We're super, super psyched to have you on. Thank you. I'm really interested in like strategic theory concepts and so forth. And I'd be really interested in your take on like, what is the relationship specific to China between its purported declared no first use policy and the expansion of its expansion and diversification of its arsenal, like, do you see, like, speaking to that broader picture of, like, the relationship between doctrine and force levels, do you see China's declared posture changing? Perhaps not in the way that the US has throughout history, but, like, you know, does an expansion imply, or to what extent does expansion imply a shift from no first use?
That's a great question. So let's make a couple clarifications, right? China does have a no first use policy that it still is the open public, the public declaratory policy, right? So that means that it promises to never use nuclear weapons first, that it will, if it ever uses nuclear weapons, it'll be in retaliation after somebody else has already detonated nuclear weapons on China, and that it'll never use its nuclear weapons to threaten countries without nuclear weapons. So it won't be a nuclear bully. That's the declaratory policy. I think a key, again, analytic kind of assumption we're building into our research here is that China is violating its own declaratory policy in our hypothetical research world here, right? Because by the books, that means the US or anyone else should be able to conduct immense wide-ranging conventional strikes on the Chinese mainland. And as long as the US or another country does not use nuclear weapons, China should never use nuclear weapons first. So for Australia, a country that does not have nuclear weapons, Australia should be able to conduct any conventional strike it sees fit without, on the books, any concern about Chinese nuclear first use. Now, obviously, that's a declaratory policy, and that's only as good as Xi Jinping or other top Chinese leadership actually abiding by that policy, which can change in an instant. And so we wanted to explore, what if this policy changes? So that's where it gets into actual nuclear capabilities and, you know, a lot of kind of nuclear theory we use in our research. I think you can imagine many different ways for Chinese declaratory policy going in the future, but there's a lot of diplomatic political capital gained for Beijing by sticking with no first use. And so far, there's no indication they're actually going to abandon it. And historically, what they've done is kept with this no first use declaratory policy while every so often hinting in unofficial channels that they might not always actually abide by it. So they get a little benefit of hedging this risk while actually formally sticking to their declaratory policy. So we think this is probably something that might be exacerbated over time. But we aren't projecting that China will abandon its no first use policy anytime soon. And that's not something we directly explored in our research.
Interesting. Interesting. And in terms of China, you know, with the buildup, has their language in, I know you study military journals from China and China's official statements around nuclear weapons, has their language changed at all, even though their no first use policy has stayed stable?
That's a great question. So China has never formally acknowledged it's actually building up its nuclear weapons stockpile. China has never publicly declared how many nuclear weapons it actually has, right? I believe the most it's ever said is maybe in 2006, it said we have the lowest number of nuclear weapons for any of the five main nuclear powers. So that only gives you kind of a relative number. Back then, that was also, you know, basically 20 years ago. And so China is very much not transparent about its nuclear capabilities. Does not talk publicly a whole lot about, you know, any details of nuclear strategy. And a lot of our understanding of Chinese nuclear strategy is very derivative, and something we deal with in the report is based on some older sources that we believe are still high quality, but, you know, aren't published last year. What we can see and what, you know, DoD has talked about publicly is that some select Chinese military or Chinese military affiliated writings have over the years talked not just about kind of big picture strategic nuclear weapons, but precise low yield nuclear weapons. And so it's difficult to really understand how much interest or consensus there is within the broader Chinese military about those capabilities. But I do think it's interesting to note that some of those conversations are apparently popping up in, you know, Chinese military circles. And that's something that, you know, could potentially really change some of these escalatory risks if the Chinese leadership feels that nuclear weapons are, you know, more acceptable or, you know, easier to use with lower risk than all-out nuclear war. So that's certainly something to watch in the future.
Yeah. I mean, that kind of leads us into, you know, the next, you know, topic of discussion, which is your study examined a whole bunch of ways, potential pathways to nuclear use, things that you called in the report escalation logics and escalation pathways. Really interesting. And I know we're not going to have time to summarize all of them because, as in a typical RAND report, you've been very extensive and complete in exploring them. So can you describe the range of the logics and some of the more likely or concerning pathways? That might be a way to dive into it a little bit without spending, you know, the whole half hour on that topic.
For the logics, we were looking to try to cover the entire space of plausible reasons that nuclear war could start. And they fall under four primary categories. There's intentional nuclear use. So that's exactly what it sounds like. Someone wants to use a nuclear weapon because they think it'll win them the war. It'll get them some military objective that they couldn't otherwise get. And other options like that. Then there's this category of inadvertent nuclear use. And the idea there is that you sort of, it's a blend of intentionally using it and unintentionally using it. So maybe you got a radar signal that the US was sending an ICBM toward you and it was wrong, but then it was, so you intentionally then responded by using a nuclear weapon, but it was sort of an inadvertent use in that sense. As I just mentioned, there's this concept of accidental nuclear use or unintentional, I guess. So that could be like a failure of a weapon and it, there was a technical failure, maybe someone pushes the wrong button. And finally, there's the concept of catalytic war. So that's a third party, either intentionally or inadvertently starting a nuclear exchange. So those are that's the basic logic space that we came up with. And from there, we attempted to think of unique pathways that are a little bit more prescribed than the logics. So for example, for intentional nuclear use, as I said before, there's a variety of reasons that someone might choose to use a nuclear weapon, right? But one of those might be because they're trying to get a specific military effect. So, you know, maybe you're a lot of the way into a war, your conventional forces have been denuded and, China wants to shut down Andersen Air Force Base. That is their intent. And they think that their best bet for actually effectively doing that is to use a nuclear weapon to sort of shut down the capabilities of that base. That's an example of a pathway, right? Well, that's a vignette that describes the pathway, which is the operational use for specific military effect. So we came up with 17 of these pathways. Originally, I think we brainstormed in the 50s and we sort of grouped them together because several of them were just variations of each other. So these 17 are unique. And for each of these pathways, we created a little vignette like the one that I just shared with you. And the idea of the vignette was just to illustrate in very, very broad strokes how these pathways sort of could unfold with no real detail, right? Just like very broad strokes. But the reason we did that is because, and this was the aim of our research, we were looking for things that Air Force Global Strike Command and specifically conventional long-range strike, U.S. conventional long-range strike, things that could be done with conventional long-range strike to minimize escalation and reduce the chance of Chinese nuclear first use. And I admit it might sound a little strange, but why focus so much on conventional long-range strike? And the answer is, I think, twofold. One is it's a very scary capability, right? There's really no other capability that can just penetrate and not be seen that exists. It's dual-natured. conventional and nuclear, most of the systems, many of the systems anyway, including the new bomber, the B-21. Basically, many of the pathways include long-range strike in them, sort of being a driver, at least having a role. And also our project was funded by Air Force Global Strike Command, so that was, you know, their interest, right? So this is not to say that U.S. conventional long-range strike is the only driver, potential driver of Chinese nuclear first use. We would never say that, of course, but we do think it is a valid question and an important question to ask and to think about. So anyway, we took those vignettes and we were looking for touch points, basically intersections between where conventional long-range strike meets the vignette, if you will. And from there, we were able to derive some ideas for things that could be done to make the use of long-range strike less escalatory.
Yeah. Yeah, I think one of the things that I found really interesting was you highlight this trade-off in the study between military operational effectiveness, force survivability, and escalation management. So that was really interesting to me because a lot of past conflicts where the United States had overwhelming superiority and didn't have a, you know, an adversary that could really, you know, escalate in a serious manner like the Gulf War Allied force, the U.S. sacrificed effectiveness to increase, you know, to increase survivability or reduce collateral damage. So can you kind of describe how this new trade-off plays with long-range strike and how it might affect, you know, the use of weapons or targeting or even acquisition?
So I think everything is going to be different is the basic answer to that, right? In the past, if you're fighting a power that is not nuclear, right? Or for example, Iraq, Afghanistan, any of these more recent conflicts, there was no nuclear retaliation to worry about. In reality, they also were not going to be, you know, drowning the United States with conventional attacks either. So it kind of gave the U.S., you could argue, free rein to do whatever it wanted within sort of ethical boundaries and the public opinion and all those other, you know, factors that shape decision making in war. Everything is going to look very different if there is a conflict with China, because unlike those other adversaries, they, as Nathan just talked about, are not only nuclear power, but they're a rapidly growing nuclear power. So this project did not take a look at what happens after the first strike, after that Chinese first use. That exchange that could come after was not looked at. But I think that even just getting to that point, right, going up that escalatory ladder, if you will, there are going to be trade-offs that the U.S. has to abide by. And an example of that might be not achieving their goals fully, right? They might want to do something, but the 100% solution could simply be too escalatory because it involves a lot of mainland strikes. And by the way, and this is something that we might get in later, we're not saying that any mainland strike would necessarily lead to nuclear war tomorrow or immediately lead to nuclear war. But we're also not, but you know, I think that question of what strikes are tolerable is an open question and unanswerable today, since this very concept of a nuclear threshold is can change, right? I mean, we've seen that in Ukraine, the actions that, you know, starting a couple years ago versus the actions happening today, you know, in terms of their quote unquote escalatory potential, or at least what people might perceive as the escalatory potential has certainly shifted. And I think that that would apply to any conflict, including one between the United States and China. Nonetheless, you could imagine situations where the U.S. wants to do something, but it would just be considered too escalatory by leadership. So another option has to be found to achieve the military effect. And maybe there simply isn't one that will be quite as effective. So they might have to settle for like the 70% solution or a solution that risks a trading forces that is highly undesirable and would never be considered as an option against a different adversary. But I think that, like it or not, if there were actually a war between the United States and China, escalation concerns would be a dominant, if not the dominant factor. And I think the way the entire conflict evolves would be heavily, heavily impacted by that.
That's, it's a it's a dangerous new world. I'm interested in, because sort of we haven't really, like the Asia Pacific historically, like, yes, South Korea and Japan have had to deal with nuclear issues in the region, but to a much lesser extent, I'd argue, than Europe during the Cold War, and least again Australia. And as, you know, kind of we see shifting great power relations, you know, the real prospect of conflict in the Asia Pacific region, I'm interested in, like, we had Dr. Peter Layden on, an Australian academic, and was talking about, I loved his terminology. He used, he said, this nuclear threat business that Russia is sort of conducting. I'm interested in do you anticipate, to what extent do you anticipate China becoming more vocal about threatening to use nuclear weapons? You know, given that it has a very different strategic culture to like Russia, the United States, and so forth. Like, she seems to be a lot more subtle in his language and signaling, but might. To what extent in, I don't know, the next decade, might we see China being more vocal about nuclear weapons and nuclear signaling and so forth?
Yeah, I think that's a great question. In our report, we do consider the risks that China, both from kind of some pre-existing strategic thinking in the Chinese military and reinforced by apparent lessons they're learning from Russian attitudes and behavior in Ukraine, that we think it's certainly something the United States and coalition partners like Australia should be planning for ahead of time, that there's absolutely a risk that Beijing really leans into the nuclear buildup and these very increasingly capable nuclear forces and leverages them even short of actual nuclear use for the political or military benefits with signaling. So we wrote another report, actually the report we wrote for Carl a couple years ago for the Australian government was on Chinese deterrence signaling. And there's definitely absolutely a nuclear component of that playbook. And so, yes, there is pre-existing Chinese military thought and planning per se on this subject. So we absolutely should prepare for that to be part and parcel of a potential Taiwan scenario. I think the interesting question for Australia is that, you know, Australia is in the process starting to buy Virginia-class SSNs from the United States, right? And I know there's some in Australia talking about buying B-21s as a potential something to do, you know, in the future through AUKUS. And so Australia is going to be potentially, you know, possessing and maybe employing some of these highly capable U.S., you know, derived long-range strike systems. And so a lot of the pathways that we explored in our report for the United States may well be applicable for Australia as well. And again, according to China's no first use declaratory policy, it shouldn't be a problem. China, you know, Australia doesn't have nuclear weapons, should be an issue. I think, again, that's not a reasonable planning factor for the Australian government or others to really, you know, worst case think through. And so I think absolutely we hope that our report being publicly available will help start and drive some of these conversations in Canberra and elsewhere, you know, thinking ahead of time. And so if, you know, Australia has these capabilities, it's a potential coalition partner in the future, then, you know, yes, Canberra should be thinking about its how to manage its own use of long-range strike, but I think it's also a very apt topic for the U.S. and Australia to be thinking about today ahead of time so they don't have to figure it out on the fly in the course of a potential conflict. I think it's absolutely, you know, something. One thing that we kind of found in our recommendations, there really should be an alliance coordination aspect to these issues going forward.
Yeah, I was going to dig into the recommendations because we're getting close to the end here. looking at the recommendations and thinking about long-range strike, obviously you need enough capability to win the conflict to deter it. But if you use too much force, you might cause escalation on the Chinese side. So what's that sweet spot? What's the best long-range strike capability solutions and operational ways to use long-range strike to A, you know, help you try to win the conflict, but B, you know, help reduce the chance of nuclear escalation? I know you guys looked at this in detail.
So I'll walk you through a short logic chain and then end up with a couple thoughts on specific procurement acquisition decisions that might be useful to consider. Rand has done previous work on U.S. theories of victory and a conflict with China. And, you know, short version of that is to say theory of victory is really, you know, the big picture story of how you think you're going to win. And that's supposed to be higher level than simply military capabilities, even military strategy and planning. But really, it boils down in the case of a Taiwan scenario to debate between cost imposition and denial. And our research found that denial was much more optimal to balance military operational effectiveness and escalation risks. It's never a guarantee, right? I think one of our key conclusions from this report is that as soon as the United States and other coalition partners intervene to defend Taiwan against the Chinese invasion, because China has a secure second strike capability, there will always be the risk of nuclear escalation and nuclear use. You cannot make that risk zero. You have to grapple that and be prepared for that the moment the United States and others enter the fight. But if you enter the fight, there are probably better ways to do it and worse ways to do it. And so our existing research suggests that denial, trying to actually stop the invasion, is better than cost imposition, right? Outside of denying the invasion, actually adding cost to Beijing, getting it to change its behavior. And so if that is true, then how do you execute denial in the best way to reduce the risk of escalation? And so one of the key points we kept coming back to in our research is that targets matter. If you think about it from China's perspective, the one thing they're probably going to know is not who blew up something, when was it blown up, how was it blown up, but just simply what was blown up. The targets matter. And so one good way to think about this is denying the invasion. Our research suggests maybe the optimal way is actually sinking amphibs and also treating air assault forces coming across the strait. So if that is true from a long-range strike perspective, then you probably want a lot of long-range anti-ship munitions. And other research from CSIS and CNS and others has suggested that DoD is probably not buying enough of those. So if that is true, then the easy, straightforward answer is buy more. And it's not just good for operational effectiveness. You know, yes, they're probably more expensive than other potential munitions, but point is, they're also good for escalation management, which is something we argue we should all care about. So that's one specific thing we really focused on as a, you know, potential recommendation for DoD. Dahlia, do you want to talk through a couple more of our recommendations?
Sure. And I'll just add on top of that, that there might be a certain irony or paradox that the listener picks up on here. Oh, buy more to be less escalatory. But a key point here is you're buying more long-range strike munitions, right? Which allows the U.S. to operate from further away from China, right? And to accurately intercept a target like an amphibious assault ship. So essentially, you're buying more, you're okay treating them, you're staying further away, and you're more accurate. So that, I think, can help to perhaps further support that idea.
So what I'm hearing is slick 'em in.
Oh, slick 'em in. Christine, you're such a fangirl. Christine just wants to buy more nuclear weapons.
Exclusively on U.S. conventional capabilities and keeping the fight below the nuclear threshold on both sides. Yes. So, all right, Dahlia, what other conventional capabilities can we buy?
Yeah, of course. No problem. So I think another recommendation that we came to that's in a similar vein is that in addition to having more, you want a good variety, right? You want to be able to sink ships effectively. That's not necessarily probably not going to be the same munition as one that's good at intercepting aircraft that are flying. So you want a good force mix, in order to be both a compelling adversary, right? We have the chance to win here, but also one that can do so from a posture that's less threatening. We focus a lot on perceptions. So the fact is, suppose you have some fancy technology that allows you to look like 100 B-21s are flying your way instead of 2 or 4. Well, you know, one is going to obviously look a lot more threatening than the other. I think that that's an example where you have a very clear opportunity for perception mismatch, right? China is perceiving that you're sending in this absolutely massive attack that isn't true. And, you know, maybe we're doing so to make it harder to intercept the real planes. But that's an example where you can easily see a perception mismatch. And we can come up with so many different examples of where our intentions and what China perceives don't match. And that's an example of a way that you could precipitate an extreme response all the way up to Chinese nuclear first use. There's things that you can do to watch out for that, right? You know, you can communicate, and it's easy to say that. It's really easy to say, yeah, president, you know, communicate, right? But there are ways of doing so. There's public signaling, there's backdoor signaling, et cetera, right? And sometimes perhaps portraying the truth may be actually a lot safer than portraying an exaggerated posture. Some other ideas that we came up with involve training and also survivability of the nuclear force, the conventional force, excuse me. So conventional long-range strike can be a driver of escalation and potentially a driver of Chinese nuclear first use. However, as I said a while ago, it's certainly not the only reason that China might decide to use a nuclear weapon. However, it could also be a very juicy and attractive target of Chinese nuclear use, right? You could have a bunch of missiles and a bunch of B-21s sitting in Anderson Air Force Base or whatnot, just juicy little targets waiting to be attacked. Well, potentially by a nuclear weapon, right? So a possible strategy there to mitigate that would be to make yourself a less attractive target. So have fewer of them in any one place, practice, train to fight through a limited nuclear attack. And that's something that I think the world in general has kind of stopped doing nearly as much of since the Cold War ended. But the more that you can project that you're prepared to fight through and rapidly recover from limited nuclear use, the less advantageous that limited nuclear use would hopefully appear to China. So those are some other ideas.
I think that's exactly right. Like the world has forgotten that nuclear weapons are a threat. They need to be thought about. And suddenly people have come to the realization that nuclear weapons still exist. And, you know, that's part of the reason why we do this podcast, is to make people aware of these issues. So really great discussion. I appreciate that, you know, the study found that, you know, you need to buy more precision conventional weapons for the Air Force. As a former program manager in Project Air Force, I will say that 9 out of 10 studies recommended that. So it's good to hear that you're still beating the drum there. And that's kind of all we have time for today. But I really want to thank our guests, Dahlia and Nathan. Great discussion. Go read their report. It's on the RAND website. It's called Denial Without Disaster. And it discusses the potential for nuclear escalation and how to reduce that and avoid crossing the nuclear threshold in conflict with China over Taiwan. Thanks for listening, and just remember to always think deterrence. Thank you for listening to NIDS Knowledge, Deterrence Down Under. This show is produced under the NIDS Podcasting Network, a division of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies. NIDS is a U.S.-based 501c3 organization dependent upon donations to provide this podcast and bring about awareness of the peacekeeping value of U.S. strength, alliances, and deterrence. You can catch all of our podcasts or provide feedback at thinkdeterrence.com. I thank our producer, Kimberly Charrington, our sponsors, and all the fantastic members of the National Institute for Deterrence Studies for making this podcast possible. Stay tuned next week for another exciting and informative NIDS Knowledge.